What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, well, we would love to take a crack at answering that question for you on today's program. And if I could give out a pro tip here, phones are all open right now. If you wait till, 30 seconds before the end of the show, not a lot we can do about that. So call now, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. We will send you a response, a quick robo response, as soon as you send us something. And then once you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Also, you can shoot us an email if you prefer that. ctc@ewtn.com is the address. ctc@ewtn.com. All right, Pedro Quiles is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. We are also on social media right now. Ace McKay taking care of things. If you are watching us on YouTube or Facebook right now, just put that question of yours in the comments box, and then Ace will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing decent. Thank you.
You've got a home invasion coming up, right? You've got family coming in from hither and yon.
Hither and yon, yep. That's right. But that's the way we like it, as you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be fantastic. We're actually counting down the hours here at EWTN until we begin the 48 hours of Christmas, which will be all day Christmas Eve Day, which is tomorrow, and all day Christmas Day. Just some fantastic program, some new shows, some favorites. So you can check EWTN.com for all the information about that, the 48 hours of Christmas. Right now, let's get to an email from Sarah. What is the difference, Dr. Anders, between trusting God and having faith in Him? Always praying for you and your listeners. Thanks for everything you do. May God bless you and everyone who makes the show possible. That's from Sarah.
Sure. So I don't know that one need posit a difference.
Okay.
Right? But if I were going to make one up, and this is, the theological category that we care about is faith.
Yes.
Right? But I think you can differentiate faith according to several aspects, and we might set trust aside as one of those. Okay. So from one point of view, faith is the will's command to the intellect to believe what God has revealed.
Okay.
Okay. And so that sounds pretty abstract, and it can be pretty abstract. So, if Catholic faith reveals, for example, that God is a Trinity, it's assenting to the fact that God is a Trinity, for example,
yeah.
Right? But there's definitely another aspect to faith, and traditional theology distinguishes what's called the fides qua and the fides quae, all right, which is the faith which I believe, the content of the faith that I confess, and then the act subjectively of believing the faith, but the faith by which I believe what the church teaches.
Okay.
And when you look at the subjective element, the act of faith by which I give myself to these propositions, that does come with what you might consider to be trust. I think a different kind of resonance, sort of nuance to it. When God commanded Abraham to get up from his homeland in Ur of the Chaldees and to go to the land God would show him, there wasn't a lot of propositional content that Abraham's intellect had to say, okay, I accept that, right? What he had to do was get up and leave, right? And that entailed the belief that God was going to take care of him along the way, right? And so entrusting yourself to God means that you entrust yourself to providence. Now, does that mean that you trust that God will ensure that it always goes well for you? I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, that's certainly not the lot of the saints. I mean, you read the lives of the saints, for many of them had pretty materially horrible lives and had nasty, rotten things happen to them. Their trust in God was rather the belief that in spite of the terrible circumstances of their life, that God was, if not visibly, at least invisibly in control of things, and that he must have a reason for having allowed this thing to come upon me, even though I don't presently experience that reason.
Okay. Appreciate that. And thank you, Sarah, so much for your question. Here's one now from Matt in Atlanta. Dr. Anders, how do I incorporate my empirical view of the natural world with faith? I work in academia. My research is in the history of science. I genuinely want to believe in the tenets of the Catholic faith, but my rational mind struggles with claims of miracles and the purpose of the sacraments. Thanks, Matt in Atlanta.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I really appreciate the question. So I'm glad you told me what your academic specialty is, because one way to go at this question is to look at the ways Catholic intellectual history have undergirded and facilitated and even led to the scientific revolution. And without the Catholic faith, there wouldn't have been a scientific revolution. And it's not an accident that the scientific revolution happened in the 16th century Western world, the Latin Catholic world, and not some other place in the world. They didn't have a scientific revolution, say, in you know, Aztec Mesoamerica. Right?
No,
I mean,
no.
And there's very good historical reasons why that's the case, right? And I won't go into all the details, but I'm going to give you a couple of resources to take a peek at. One, kind of a surface overview, you might take a look at Tom Wood's book, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, which touches on the church's influence on science, among other things. You might look at any or all of the works of Father Stanley Jaki, spelled J-A-K-I, who was a Benedictine priest and physicist who really made his bones writing about the history of science and the interplay of science and the Catholic faith. You might look at the work of Pierre Duhem, D-U-H-E-M, French historian of science, Catholic, same thing. You might look at a kind of popularization of Jaki's work, a master's thesis that's been published by Stacy Trosonkos, which is a helpful summary of Jaki's conclusions, all of which basically argue that no Catholic faith, no scientific revolution. We can get into a little bit of the reasoning for that maybe after the break.
Sounds good. So, Matt, in Atlanta, we've got more to say on this topic, so do stay with us. Hey, lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-3986. We are live today, 833-288-EWTN. So before the break, we were working on a question here from Matt in Atlanta, which I'm going to restate. Dr. Anders, how do I incorporate my empirical view of the natural world with faith? I work in academia. My research is in the history of science. I genuinely want to believe in the tenets of the Catholic faith, but my rational mind struggles with claims of miracles and the purpose of the sacraments.
Yeah, so before the break, I actually laid out a bibliography for the fellow about good research on the relationship of Catholicism to the development of the scientific revolution. They basically argue without the Catholic faith, there wouldn't have been a scientific revolution. And you know, at the heart of the Catholic philosophical project is the prologue to the Gospel of John, which made Catholic philosophy possible. And that the thesis that in the beginning was the Word, and it was the Word that enlightens every man, that was also God, who came into the world and became incarnate for the sake of our salvation. And so the Catholic faith has traditionally interpreted that to mean that the Word, being the principle of the rationality of the universe, is the highest principle and has an intrinsic relationship to human intelligence, that humans have a God-given intrinsic capacity to understand the rational order of the world. And so there was a co-inherence of Greek philosophy and the origins of Western science in antiquity with the Christian view of theology. And because of that, there was always a really strong commitment to the idea that faith and reason can never be in conflict. And for Catholics, that means something very different than it means for, say, like fundamentalist Protestants. For a fundamentalist Protestant, if faith and science seem to be in conflict, the fundamentalist Protestant says, well, the scientist must have made a mistake. So we reconcile them by, you know, by throwing out the scientific conclusion. And the Catholic faith has never taken that exclusive point of view. It says, well, if there seems to be a conflict, there's a mistake somewhere. But we don't know where it is yet until we do the research. And so, you know, to take a classic example, Cardinal Bellarmine, when he was investigating the Galileo hypothesis, his initial response was, well, I think Galileo is probably wrong. However, if Galileo can give me a physical demonstration, if he can empirically demonstrate the proof of the Copernican worldview, then it'll be my biblical exegesis that's proven to be wrong, not the other way around.
Wow.
And I'll go back and rethink the way I'm interpreting Scripture to accommodate what I know to be an empirical fact. There were other challenges to an empirical view of the world. One that came by way of Arabian philosophy was a philosophical doctrine known as occasionalism. Occasionalism took the view that there are no instrumental causes in reality, that everything is caused immediately by the will of God. Al-Ghazali, the Muslim philosopher, took that position. He argued, for example, that fire doesn't burn a cotton ball, but that God burns the cotton ball on the occasion of it being brought into contact with fire, that there are no independent agents, that everything is done immediately by the will of God. And he held that position because he thought that if everything depends immediately on God, that somehow makes God more powerful. Thomas Aquinas opposes that. Catholic theologian Thomas Aquinas opposes that, and he gives a lot of arguments. But one of the reasons he gives against that, he says, well, if that's the position, then empirical knowledge is impossible and induction is impossible. Induction is not impossible, you know, therefore, etc. He also took the position that that's a bizarre view of God's power, that you would think an agent is more powerful if he's able to work effectively through secondary causes, right? And the Al-Ghazali's concept of God seems to be that God's sovereignty can only be exercised immediately, and he can't work through agents. And Thomas says, well, actually, it's more glorifying to God to imagine that he could effectively bring about his will by working through agents that have genuine secondary causality. And thus, we can also preserve induction and empiricism. The Greek way of thinking about science and philosophy, of course, was largely deductive. You come up with a theory about the way reality works, and then you logically deduce, you know, syllogistically a consequence. And that was a real impediment to the development of the scientific method. And for reasons that are too pedantic for me to go into right now, late medieval Catholic philosophy went in a very different direction and enabled a way of thinking about the relationship to God and nature that was more extrinsic and less intrinsic, and made nature appear more contingent, more haphazard, and therefore less amenable to deductive analysis, and demanding more in the way of empirical and inductive method, which leads, well, directly into the methodology of the scientific revolution. So there's just a lot of reasons why Catholicism set up a view of nature, a philosophy of nature that facilitated the development of science in ways that other intellectual systems and cultures did not. And I would encourage you to look into that bibliography.
Matt, thanks so much for your email, and glad to hear from you listening in Atlanta. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We'll get to the phones in just a second. Let me tell you about a great book available now from EWTN Publishing, St. Paul on the Power of the Cross by Father Mitch Pacwa. In this great book, Father Mitch unpacks the letters of St. Paul in an energizing study for individuals or groups. You can discover a central theme of St. Paul's teachings and writings, and then, of course, the role of the cross of Jesus Christ for the salvation of souls. You'll discover how the writings of this pillar of the church can draw you closer to Christ crucified. Do check it out, St. Paul on the Power of the Cross by Father Mitch Pacwa. Available right now at ewtnrc.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic. ewtnrc.com. EWTN.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We'll begin with Brian in Pittsburgh, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today, sir?
Is that Brian?
Hey, Brian in Pittsburgh, how you doing?
Okay, fine. Dr. Anders, question. How did Jesus's birth physically differ from a regular birth, or, you know, just a regular birth? Is Jesus's birth different?
Yeah.
Not through the birth canal, that type of thing.
Yep, yep. Well, of course, the most significant difference was that Christ's conception was virginal, right? The Blessed Virgin Mary conceived virginally and didn't have sexual relations with men. And the Church teaches that she maintained her virginity, and they have a fairly robust concept of virginity here, meaning it's not just violated by physical union with a man, but that her body remained physically intact and undamaged by the process of parturition, where normally, you know, when women give birth, it's pretty traumatic on the body, and would, you know, that would definitely leave signs of that in one's anatomy, that, okay, things are not intact the way they used to be.
Yeah.
And that's not the case of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So the way Christ passed through her body was itself miraculous, such that she retained the virginal intact integrity of her physical body.
Okay. Brian, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Three lines open at the moment, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're going to go to a call that we received overnight on our EWTN listener comment line.
My name is Sandy from South Dakota. I would like to know more about the holy days of the Church. They've taken some off and renamed some.
Okay.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, now, see, you may have to help me out here, Tom.
I'll try.
Let's see. Starting January 1, right, we have the Feast of Mary, the Mother of God.
Yes.
All right. And then, of course, we have, every Sunday is a holy day. Easter, of course, is a holy day, but it falls on a Sunday. After Easter, we would have, Pentecost is not a holy day, right? Is the next one on the list, the Assumption? Is that August?
Well, as I'm looking at the list here, it's January 1st, the Solemnity of Mary, the Holy Mother of God. May 9th, the Solemnity of the Ascension.
Oh, right. Of course, Ascension Thursday, but sometimes that one gets transferred.
It does. Right. August 15th is the Assumption.
August is the Assumption, right.
Yes. November 1st, All Saints Day.
Yep.
December 9th, Feast of the Immaculate Conception. June 7th, the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus.
That's not a holy day of obligation.
Well, this is what AI is telling me.
I got to go back and hit a lot of confessions if that's the case. I don't think that's the holy day.
We may have to revisit this in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
but has anything changed as far as, you know, what was a feast day or what was a holy day?
Yeah, you
is
know,
no longer.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah, and
okay.
And to be honest with you, I couldn't give you a historical rundown on all of that. You know, I know that the universal mass obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Is actually an innovation of the 1917 Code of Canon Law.
Oh.
So before that time, there would have been local obligations. You know, a particular bishop could mandate that people in his diocese go to Mass on this or the other day, but
uh-huh.
there actually wasn't a universal obligation throughout the entire Catholic world to attend Mass on the same day until the 1917 Code of Canon Law.
We will revisit this question probably after the break. Right now, let's go to Betsy in Ann Arbor, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hey, Betsy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. A couple of questions, if I may, please. The
yes.
first one is, which author do you recommend for Confessions of St. Augustine? And the second question is, I was at a dinner party just 2 days ago, and I was talking with, met somebody for the very first time from the Middle East. We started talking about world affairs, and I asked him, are you Catholic or Muslim? And he said, Catholic, and the Catholic Church is the biggest business in the world. Don't get me started. Yet you wear the crucifix and the Blessed Mother, and then I didn't know, I just met the guy I didn't know how to respond to the biggest business in the world.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the question. Of course, it isn't a business. I mean, it isn't a business.
Right.
It's not a business. I mean, a business, you know, produces a product that it sells for a profit, and the Catholic Church doesn't produce a product as such, and it doesn't offer it for profit, right? And so, I mean, it's just the model is just entirely wrong. Now, that's not to say that there haven't been individual Catholics who have profited from their traffic in Catholic ideas or Catholic paraphernalia or, you know, Catholic whatever. I'm in the public speaking business, and, you know, I it's part of how I support my family, and that entails talking about the Catholic faith. But I'm not the Catholic Church. I'm just a guy. You know, there are Catholic publishers who have a business of publishing Catholic books. They make money publishing Catholic books, but again, they're not the Catholic Church. They're just, you know, some book publisher somewhere. But the Catholic Church is not a business. I mean, it's kind of an absurd allegation. And, you know, I think probably what he means is he's taking it as a metaphor, you know, to say the church is, you know, maybe venal or money grubbing or commercially motivated or something. And I think if that's his position, I mean, first of all, it's really just kind of a lousy business. Right, to begin with,
you know, if you look at it that way,
I mean, I used to work for a Catholic diocese. Spent, you know, about 8 years working for a Catholic diocese, and actually, one of the reasons I don't have that job anymore is they failed as a business.
Right? Wow.
They couldn't make payroll, you know, and that's not uncommon. And you know, individual Catholic parishes typically, you know, they're not running way ahead in the black on the old accounting statements, you know, there are individual Catholic dioceses or institutions that have money. There are vastly more that don't. You know, I know priests from the third world, and that's where all the Catholic growth is happening.
Yeah.
Where the annual salary of a serving Catholic priest is, you know, under $400 a year.
Wow.
Right? A year.
A year.
Right? And I mean, like, this is not, I mean, if it's a business, it's like the worst business model known to mankind, right? I mean, it's a really lousy business model, but it's just not a business. That's just a terrible analogy.
All right. And Betsy, thank you so much for your call today. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Tom, a first-time caller from Tennessee, listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Tom. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, good afternoon to you, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Merry Christmas, both of you guys.
Thank you.
Dr. Anders, you are... voice of reason, so I got to get your opinion. My dad passed November 1.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you, sir. We did pray for years for him. He got anointed the sick, and he got the apostolic pardon about 10, 12 hours before he passed. The priest came to our house, and my dad comes from a different generation. Like, he's not going to go talk to priests in the confessional. I don't know if he made an act of contrition or anything like that. I've had a lot of really good priests that's told me some good stuff. I've read a lot of really positive things. I've also seen some stuff that probably caused a little bit of doubt. How much confidence can I have in all this? I keep praying for him regardless. I have a feeling he could be in heaven. I pray for him like he's in purgatory, but I just really, really miss him this, like, Christmas season.
Yeah. Tom, I understand. I lost my father 4 years ago. It was terribly difficult for me, and I'm deeply sympathetic. And, of course, this time of year, of course, you're going to be thinking about him. And it was so soon, and so my heart really goes out to you and your family. And, you know, for me, one of the great blessings of being Catholic is when you lose a loved one, Catholic faith tells us that not only do you have the hope of their eternity and of seeing them again one day, but you're not cut off, even now, from some kind of interchange with that soul. Now, that individual is not going to communicate to you, but we hold by faith that that soul can pray for you as you can pray for that individual. And so there's still a relationship of active service and love that's being exhibited, being displayed by both parties there. And so you can feel connected in the knowledge that you are, in fact, connected through the Catholic faith, through charity, through the life of grace, through the work of prayer, and all that's deeply comforting. In terms of, you know, the question of your father's salvation, everything you told me says, well, you know, we have the virtue of hope.
Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Don't sit on that question. Let's get it answered. 833-288-3986. Congratulations going out to one of our longtime EWTN radio partners, and that would be Catholic Radio of Marshalltown. Serving Marshalltown, Iowa, they've got two stations broadcasting in English and Spanish, now celebrating 21 years with EWTN. Congratulations to Deacon Roger Polt and Bob Dick and their fabulous team there in Marshalltown from your friends here at EWTN Radio. Got an email from Bob Dick just today, David. A little Merry Christmas email. There is not a nicer group of people on this planet than the folks that have sacrificed so much to put Catholic radio stations on the air in their communities. I mean, it is amazing.
I second that. And I mean, I've met these folks and they blow me away.
Some of these people have actually put up their homes as collateral to get that first stick on the air and broadcasting. That is a commitment. Hey, one of our unofficial researchers, that'd be Jack Williams, did the legwork here and filled us in on the holy days of obligation, and that would be January 1st, yep. Mary, Mother of God, also the Ascension, the Assumption, All Saints Day, the Immaculate Conception, and of course,
there you go.
Christmas.
And Christmas.
So yep. There you go. Jack, thank you very much for that. We also got a caller just a few minutes ago, couldn't stay on the line. This person said, you did not give David a recommendation of best version of Confessions of St. Augustine.
Well, I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
I'm going to give you two. So the one that I use, and look, I'll be honest with you, one of the reasons that I use it is that I've been using it for years.
Okay.
So it's all marked up. I'm used to it. You know, it's familiar to me. It's good. It's competent. It's not the most recent, but I'm very happy with it. And that's the Penguin Classics translation by R.S. You get a load of this last name, Pinecoffin.
Wow.
P-I-N-E hyphen C-O-F-F-I-N.
Pinecoffin.
Yeah. It's like, it's a double last name.
I get it.
I'm like, it's not Coffin Pine. It's Pinecoffin. And I'm like, of all the things to name yourself, Pinecoffin. But it's good. I like Pinecoffin's translation. Here's another one that's much more recent and has a lot of acclaim, particularly for its nuanced attention to philosophical distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is by Thomas Williams. Now, I'm gonna give you a little inside baseball here. I studied with Thomas Williams.
Really?
Yeah. He is a philosopher, a historian of medieval philosophy, mm-hmm. and I studied with. He was actually a reader on my doctoral dissertation at the University of Iowa.
Wow.
And he's moved on since then, and is a distinguished professor or something in another institution. But I remember Dr. Williams as being one of the best prepared, engaging, passionate teachers of philosophy I've ever had. And he was just nutso for Augustine. He just thought Augustine was the bomb. And when he taught medieval philosophy at the university, clearly, his specialty was Duns Scotus, but Augustine was his hero. He just thought Augustine was great. And he did an Augustine class that I didn't get to take. And I kick myself. It's one of those regrets that I have in life that I didn't take his class. But I had colleagues that did, and they said the way he did it is he structured the flow of the course around the confessions. So, as you're walking Augustine's own philosophical autobiography through the confessions, you would be reading on the side, all of these treatises that Augustine writes at these different stages of his philosophical development.
Wow.
So the narrative is enhancing your reading of the... So, Williams was just... He still is. I mean, he's actually one of those people that was selected to be in the great courses. He does one of the medieval philosophy courses for the great
courses.
Really? He was just a great pedagogue, great Scotus scholar, great Augustine scholar. His hobby on the side was translating medieval Latin texts.
Wow.
Yeah, he was quite something. So I haven't actually worked through that text all the way. I've taken a look at it, but that's also very good. So I'd go for either Pinecoffin, which is the one I have typically used for all these years, but I'm kind of excited about Thomas Williams' translation, too.
Couple of great recommendations for you. Thank you so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. Call now, 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Interesting question here from Shelley. Dr. Anders, you explained that for a Catholic marriage to be valid, it must be unitive and open to life or procreation, if I understand correctly. However, Josephite marriages like Joseph and Mary had also seemed to be considered valid, so I'm not sure I understand how that is possible. Can you please shed some light on this? Thanks a lot, Shelley.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So, you know, the reason, one of the reasons why the Catholic faith acknowledges the Josephite marriage and the reason they call it the Josephite marriage as opposed to like the Ralphian marriage or something is because of St. Joseph, who made a commitment to be the protector and the patron of the Holy Family, right? The guardian of the Holy Family, and though he never consummated his marriage with a Blessed Virgin, but to suggest that that marriage was not open to life would be a complete misunderstanding, right? It was open to life, and it wasn't life that was going to happen in the normal way, but it was definitely open to life, We have the situation in the Catholic faith more commonly than the Josephite marriage of the elderly couple or the infertile couple that marries. And people say, well, if a marriage is about being open to the procreation of children, then how can that be valid as well? And the answer is that it remains the kind of relationship that would naturally be fulfilled in children if such were possible, right?
Okay.
And so, if you get married at the age of 75, I'd say, you know, there's always Abraham and Sarah, but the odds of that happening in your case are astronomically low, right? But you're still pledging yourself to that kind of relationship.
Sure.
Such that if we were to give ourselves to sexual union and children would be the consequence and we're not going to do anything to frustrate that, then we would welcome that outcome, right? But in the that's unlikely that that's going to happen because of our physical situation or whatever have you. So we're still going to join in that kind of relationship where our orientation towards one another is to be fruitful, to be a sign of life, to be a source of blessing to one another and to the community and to the Catholic faith, and to live this vocation before the world as a domestic church. And if God doesn't bless us with our own biological children, then we'll try to be spiritual fathers and mothers to those that we can, and to model that kind of relationship, even if children actually don't come about. And there are situations like Louis and Zélie Martin, who married with the intent of having a Josephite marriage. They actually did intend that, and they made it a few weeks or something, and they were at confession, and the priest was like, "Are you out of your mind? get busy and make some babies." And so plans can change. And they did, in fact, and they gave the world multiple saints in consequence,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So all that is taken into account.
Very good. Shelley, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from, looks like, Nile. If God created all, including evil and hell and sin, do good and evil lose their meaning? Because if God is all good and he created evil, is evil now good? I believe your answer will be yes, because I've heard many Catholics here more or less call evil good because it's ultimately all a part of his plan.
Okay, thanks. So Catholic theologians have worked on this question for a very long time, and none more authoritatively than St. Augustine. And the consistent answer that Catholics have given through the centuries is that God did not create sin or evil. He did not. And one of the ways that they account for that fact is to posit that sin and evil have no ontological substance. That sin is not a substance. It's not a thing like a dog or a cat or a tree, or a person. And everything that has its own independent existence, that's what it means to be a substance, to sort of exist on one's own.
Uh-huh.
Everything that has its own independent existence owes its existence directly to God. Sin is not like that. It's not one of those things. Sin is the name we give to the nature of an action by a rational agent, an action that lacks conformity to the rule of right reason. So to have sin, you must have a sinner.
Yeah.
God creates sinners. He doesn't create sin. Sin is what happens when the rational agent, a human being or an angel,
uh-huh,
t- takes an action that lacks conformity to the rule of right reason. That lack of conformity, which is technically an absence, not a presence, is what we call sin. And so that's how you can have a universe where everything that exists comes from God. You can also have sin, and you can have the consequence that God did not create sin. All of these things can be true simultaneously, provided you acknowledge that sin is not a substance, right?
Okay.
So why does God permit sin is a better way of framing it, and that's so that he can bring about a greater good.
Okay. Nile, thank you so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Don't forget, coming up next on most of these EWTN stations, it's Open Line Monday with your host on Mondays, Father John Trigilio. That's coming up next at 3 p.m. Eastern on most of these EWTN stations. Let's go now to John in St. Louis, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hello, John. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, hi. Merry Christmas. I just kind of have an unusual, I don't know, unusual question, but I'm going to be 70 next year and born and raised Catholic. I have three daughters, sent them all to Catholic schools. I'm up to nine grandkids. And I know with me personally, you know, I kind of struggled with the Catholic faith for a long time. Not, you know, back in the 70s wasn't all that great as far as an education. And even my daughters kind of struggled with it as well. So, anyway, now being grandfather, and I'm more Catholic than ever, and Dr. Anders has been a big part of that, and I've wanted to, I have one step-grandson that I've been thinking about lately, and that is that he's transferring from a public school to a Catholic school, but he's transferring naturally because of wrestling and football. So he's now going to a Catholic school. I'm not sure exactly how much his faith is, but he's going to Catholic school, and I ask him, hey, how's it going? You have religion classes? And he's like, well, it's sort of a general, and it feels like kind of when I went to school and my daughters went to school. So anyway, with all my grandkids, they're all, even my daughters, are all on their faith journeys, and they're progressing along. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is get preachy about it, because that always seems to be the worst thing to do. But with him in particular, since he's actually going to a Catholic school, I'm trying to figure out something to encourage him. One basic thing is things like, why do you go to Mass every week? And I know Dr. Anders had a whole sort of answer to that question. Something I remember a few weeks ago, like back in the 1900s, where the Catholic Church came down and said that this was a reason. But maybe even more general, if there's any sort of a book or something that would be good for teenage boys to get them more interested or have some questions that they can answer that they have.
Yeah, sure. So I have a number of thoughts. First of all, you mentioned having struggled with your Catholic faith and your daughter struggled as well. Well, you know, Tom struggled with his Catholic faith. I've struggled with my Catholic faith. Struggling with the faith is part of being a Catholic, and it's not anything deficient in a person that they struggle. I mean, I get up every morning and I put on my Catholic shoes and I make a determination to continue to live life as a Catholic, and sometimes that decision is easier than others. Uh-huh. Right? Sometimes you have problems and challenges, whether intellectual or existential or moral, that make that a difficult choice to live, and that's just part of being Catholic, and that's taking up the cross and following Christ. So nothing shameful at all in having struggled in one's Catholic faith. I love that he wrestles.
Yeah,
I'm a big wrestling fan myself.
You are,
you know. I have a wrestler in the family, and I think that's just great, fantastic, and athletics is can be a really important part of one's moral formation, and you can there are virtues that you can gain of teamwork and fortitude and self denial and perseverance, and all those things can play into the development of moral character. I mean, they can run the opposite direction as well, but they can be occasions for spiritual growth. And a lot of people have come to a deeper engagement in their faith through the camaraderie and solidarity of a Catholic athletic team. I mean, honestly, that's a vehicle, right? I hear what you're saying about religion instruction in the Catholic school, and it's sometimes it's fantastic, sometimes it's not. You know, I hope very much that this Catholic school keeps the church's philosophy of education in mind, which is that the entire institution is supposed to be catechetical. It's not just something limited to religion class,
mm-hmm.
but the way students treat one another, the way they're treated by faculty, obviously the life of faith and the sacraments and prayer, and moral expectations, all those things can play into the culture of a school. And quite honestly, when it comes to the act of faith, it is very often, particularly at this age, more caught than taught. And, just at the human level, the sociology on having and keeping faith suggests that people are most likely to believe the way their friends believe. And that's true, for political ideologies, religions, personal tastes and fashion. I mean, you name it, whatever it is, we tend, birds of a feather, it's not birds of a feather flocking together, people tend to change their feathers to match the flock.
Well, yeah.
Right, yeah. And so if he's in a Catholic environment with practicing Catholic kids that believe and faculty that believe, that can be helpful. Of course, there's the other kind of Catholic school too, where that's not the case. So that's all good. The most important thing you can do is be in relationship with him and draw him out lovingly in a non-threatening way to talk and share his issues and concerns.
Yeah.
And then you can gently reflect back how the wisdom of the Catholic faith has informed your ability to handle those life challenges and do so in a way that he would find encouraging and inviting. When you talk about, is there a particular book? So one that comes to mind is Dr. Peter Kreft, who just seems to spit out a book a week, for the last 50 years, has one that's called, is it called like 16 Reasons Why or something like that? We've given it out on the air before.
I think so.
And he wrote it specifically for post-confirmation age teenagers addressing really basic questions about the Catholic faith, like how do I know there's a God, or and how do I get to heaven, and why mm-hmm. do I go to Mass, and that's a pretty age-appropriate book. Whether grandson will read it or not, I have no idea. I know when I was 16, I read books, but typically not the ones that my grandparents gave me, and they would go on the shelf. So is no telling whether he'll read it or not, but that's one that I would consider.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, John?
No, that's, I'm sorry, that's really, really very helpful. And, it seems to me, even with my daughters, it seems like something typically happens to them which causes their faith to really kick in.
Hmm. I will say, this is not exactly about the development of the Catholic faith specifically. I don't know how old your grandson is, but in my very limited experience, I think the passage from sophomore to junior year of high school, from 15 to 16 typically in age, mm-hmm. or 16 to 17, it coincides typically in the United States with the age in which a lot of kids get access to automobiles and therefore to a kind of autonomy that they haven't had before. I typically have experienced that, witnessed that as a very dangerous moment in the life of teenagers. And I've known kids that were in 10th grade, they were goody two shoes. And then halfway into 11th grade, they were hell on wheels.
Yeah.
And I saw that in some of my own kids. I had one child who, when he was a sophomore, going into his junior year. And I said, so-and-so, this is my experience. This is what I've observed. I've observed that when you go through this particular age transition, that you have to make a conscious decision about the kind of man you're going to be. And these are the temptations. And this is what I've seen happen. And this is how I've seen people's lives get off track here.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you make the right one. And that's all I said. I shut up.
Wow.
And he told me years later, he said, I thought about what you said. And I decided the day you put that challenge to me that I was going to be one of the ones that made the right decision.
Wow. You planted a very good seed there.
And, one out of five isn't bad. but it worked. And I'm very proud of the decisions that young man made, right? He's a lot older now. But
yeah.
So that's another something to think about.
John, thanks so much for your call. By the way, one of the books that Dr. Kreeft has written, 40 Reasons I Am a Catholic.
Okay, there's
40
one.
Reasons. There's also, looks like another publisher has 7 Reasons to Be Catholic. So there's plenty out there. If you do what I did, which is do a quick research here, and just click on Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T. I believe he pronounces it Kreeft. And then just put in reasons, you'll probably get something there. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Paul in El Paso, listening on Amazon Echo.
Sorry, real quick.
Yeah,
Because God is Real, 16 Questions, 1 Answer by Peter Kreeft.
Oh,
very
good.
I just looked it up. That's what I was thinking.
Very good.
Sorry, now let's go to Paul.
Paul, what's on your mind today, sir?
Okay, Dr. Anders, this is my third time calling. This time I have a question about defending why Catholics pray to saints. I have an intern who's not Catholic and was saying, you know, I hate when people tell me I need to pray to Saint Anthony to find something. I told her, you don't have to pray to him. It's not really a dogmatic thing to do as a Catholic, but we do it. And I didn't really know how to defend it. I know there's a way to defend it when talking about how Jesus spoke to Moses.
Yep,
at some
I can
point,
help you.
It
I can help you.
It didn't really sound clear, but yeah.
Yep. Okay. So first of all, the whole like praying to Saint Anthony when I lose something bit is the least important aspect of what it means to have a devotion to a saint. And if there's something about Catholic devotional tradition that I would let go, if I had to let something go, I'd let that go. Okay. But I want to defend prayer to the saints on another basis, not on the fact that he happens to be good at finding lost keys. Right? I want to give you another reason to pray to the saints. So, first of all, in terms of the logic of the practice, and then I'll get to the scripture behind the practice, the logic of the practice is simple, that St. James tells us the prayer of a righteous man avails much. And therefore, the prayers of the saints, who we know are confirmed in holiness, are more efficacious. And God wants us to ask for their prayers because, among other things, he wants us in the habit of praying for one another and being prayed for by one another, because our salvation is not a solitary individual thing, but it takes place in a community. And we are saved through charity. We're saved by being transformed in charity. Charity is a habit. It's a practice of caring about the concerns of other people and being willing to be cared about in turn. And so, could God do everything directly without the intervention or action of secondary agents? Of course he could. But that's not the world he made. He made a world of humans in relationship, and he wants us to be saved in relationship to one another. And the most important way in which we express charity to one another in our Christian life is through bearing up one another's burdens in prayers. And just like we would ask a friend on earth to pray for us if we were in trouble or pray for them, we believe that the community of the faithful, the communion of the saints, is something that extends beyond the grave, right? And so that makes a lot of sense. Now, the other aspect of praying to the saints is if I have the habit of cultivating devotion to a saint and asking for that saint's prayers, then I am necessarily reflecting on that saint's life and holiness. And the saint, therefore, becomes a model to me of Christian piety, of Christian holiness, of Christian virtue. So, you know, to take an example, I'm a kind of, you know, armchair theologian, and I like to try to think of myself as an aspiring Catholic intellectual. And so I have as models for my Christian life St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, as anybody who's interested in theology would. And they model to me, okay, what does it look like to be a saint, a holy person, who is engaged in the practice, the job of theology? If I were an attorney, I would cultivate a devotion to St. Thomas More, the patron saint of lawyers.
Yeah.
Right? Not because I think he's going to help me win cases, but because he's going to help me know what holiness looks like when you're in the legal profession,
mm-hmm.
right? Et cetera. If I'm a, you know, I'm a Catholic father, so I'm going to look to St. Joseph or maybe Louis Martin as a model of what does holiness look like as a Catholic father or a Catholic husband, right? And that's a really, really, really powerful motive for developing a devotion to a particular saint. And having the sense that I'm in a personal relationship with that saint through mutually intercessory prayer enhances that sense of connectedness, that identity that helps me pursue the life of holiness. So these are really, really strong motives to engage in the practice. Now, in terms of scripturally, in the book of Revelation, chapter 5, the Bible tells us that the saints in heaven offer our prayers to God. They don't just pray for us, but they're involved in the actual transmission of my prayer. They get in between me and God. That's what Scripture says about them. And if we didn't have the music, I could give you some more scriptural citations, but that's the basic idea.
Paul, thanks so much for your great call from El Paso. Glad that you're listening there. Dr. David Anders, may I wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Tom.
Merry Christmas to all of our listeners. Don't forget, at this time tomorrow, it's going to be the 48 Hours of Christmas, nonstop Christmas programming for you all day Christmas Eve day and all day Christmas Day day. So there you go. And then we're going to be back with lots more of our live programming for you right afterwards. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Have that Merry Christmas. And remember, Christmas is not just one day. It's a whole season. So we will be back very soon. God bless. Have a great one. Merry Christmas.